the Greg Kelly Podcast. Thank you so much. Rate, subscribe, like. By the way, social media and email, the most beautiful inventions. I know there are lots of downsides. There's lots of downsides to anything ever created, but it's a forum for such kindness. The messages that folks have sent about this show and the Newsmax show, I do see a fair amount of them. I wish I could respond to each and every one. They're terrific. Your kindness, your appreciation is so appreciated. And by the way, even those who are not particularly fond of my content, 9 times out of 10, they're great too. They're funny. They're interesting. You know, they may not like it, but they're funny about not liking it. And, you know, look, that's why I'm on social media, not to find a bunch of people who agree with me. Well, that's a given. They're going to be there, right? You want some of that, but you do want the pushback as well. And I can laugh my head off at some of the most critical tweets. They're just geniuses, some of these folks. I wanted to tell you one other thing. I found a new way to stay really super organized. It's really working for me. I heard a long time ago that a wish list is... I heard a long time ago that a to-do list, you know, to-do list today is like a wish list. That's what I meant to say. You know, you may or may not get around to those things. You're so inspired when you sit down and you write it and, ooh, I'm going to get all this done. But unless you have a system for getting it done, unless you have allotted time to getting each one done, you're going to be out of luck. Then it becomes a wish list. And what did Tony Robbins once say? Someday is a road that leads to nowhere. And I like that a lot. Anyway, over the past couple of weeks, I have iPhone stuff. There's the calendar option, which I never really use unless it's like something really big and I set up the alarm or whatever. But now I just set up almost every moment of my day. And I should post a picture of what it looks like. Even though my responsibilities are really not much greater than anybody else's, but my schedule looks like I'm a Fortune 500 tech CEO or something like that. Everything is blocked. From 7 to 8:30, I'm reading. From 8:30 to 9, I'm on a call. From 9 to 10, I run. From 10 to 10:30, I read. From 10:30 to 11, I'm on the train. From 11 to 11:15, I'm doing something else. From 11:15 to 12 o'clock, it goes on like that. And then there's a place in the day where I can get like my chores done. If I have to call somebody or whatever, those calls will be done from 1:15 to 1:45 every single day. That's when I address it. Anyone can set that up. I love it. It's really a lot of fun. Does that make sense? Because I've never... And I've had this calendar in my pocket ever since I got my iPhone, which was, 10 years ago. And we all have one. If you got an Android, you've got one too. And now that I'm really using it, you know, I've always been looking for the best system available. And it was there all along, at least so far. And I'm tweaking it. I haven't found the perfect schedule, but getting there. And it's actually, I woke up this morning and it almost felt like Friday, Thursday, Wednesday, like any other day, because I have almost like this muscle memory now of what to do, when to do it, which is actually good. And did I tell you I got this going on? This has been going on since before I got into this schedule, but I have now engineered my life to the point where Sunday nights feel like Friday nights. You know, Friday night, everybody lives for Friday. And, you know, that's when we come alive, and that's when, you know, that's what we've been waiting for. That's not how it works anymore. I'm as excited, even more so possibly on Sunday night, which used to be, not very long ago, a night of dread and just worry and anxiety, and this terrible emptiness used to consume me on Sunday nights. It started when I was in fifth grade, maybe, and then has basically been with me for years since, engineering my life. And by the way, faith is a big part of that. It's the biggest part. All right, today we have Charles Love with us. Charles Love is an author, an educator, and a cultural analyst. He is totally, totally fascinating. I first heard of him this past summer in the middle of the protests and riots surrounding the death of George Floyd. And it's this article I'm about to read from is something that he wrote. It went mega viral. And I asked him if I could read it. He said yes. And it goes like this. What Woke Whites Get Wrong About Blacks' Priorities by Charles Love, June 28th, 2020. This month's protests started out as a black movement against police brutality, but they have a different look now. In many cases, whites have taken over. They apologize for their white privilege and, in at least one case, wash black people's feet to expiate their collective sins. Celebrities, athletes, and corporate America followed suit. Portland's police chief resigned, asking to be replaced by a black man, and the CEO of Chick-fil-A urged whites to shine the shoes of black people to show a sense of shame. But why now? To find out, I had to hear what whites were saying. I listened to the white protesters, talked with my white friends, and read articles and social media posts. What I found was white people overwhelmingly depicting black people as desperate and defeated with no way to pull themselves out of their misery. I understand your point, a white friend said when I objected to his simplistic narrative, but don't you think blacks are being oppressed? That's when I realized that white wokeness is the new factor in our national life. It has been embedded into the consciousness of whites that all blacks are the same and that they all face impossible barriers to improvement, from standardized tests to the black men being arrested on the nightly news. A growing number of whites believe that black life is unrelentingly grim. Most whites don't have many black friends to give them firsthand accounts of what their experiences are with racism. While most blacks do experience some discrimination or racial prejudice, it is rarely violent and it doesn't hold them back in a significant sense. The media give a distorted view of black life. We see this in the stories they choose to report and those they avoid. In 2018, police shot and killed 54 unarmed men. 22 were black. Compared with the percentage of blacks in the U.S. population, that figure looks disproportionate. But black people commit a disproportionate amount of violent crime and thus tend to have more interactions with the police. Every police shooting must be investigated thoroughly and fairly, but we should also demand fair and thorough media coverage of these shootings. It's telling that so many people can name some of the unarmed black men killed by police, but few can name any of the white men. Blacks do lag whites in many socioeconomic indicators, but blacks don't live in poverty, don't have constant run-ins with law enforcement, and aren't uneducated. It's important to look at racial disparities in context. Though blacks commit more violent crime than whites do in relative terms, in absolute terms, the percentage of people who commit any violent crime is tiny. The white violent crime rate is 0.12% for blacks. It is 0.44%. By any standard, most people aren't violent criminals, regardless of their race. Yet sympathetic non-blacks often see blacks as oppressed victims and with limited opportunities. Since the killing of George Floyd, I've had many conversations with whites, mostly centered on my own well-being. Many of my black friends relate stories of management at their white companies telling employees to check on their black coworkers. Everywhere one looks, organizations are showing their solidarity with Black Lives Matter, both the motto and the organization. Uber Eats canceled its delivery fees for black businesses. Turn on YouTube TV or order from Amazon and you'll see messages of support for the black community. Nike, the NFL, and others made Juneteenth a paid holiday for all employees. These gestures, mostly symbolic, suggest what whites believe blacks are concerned about. They seem insincere. Since they don't have many blacks in their social circles and having conversations, and having conversations with blacks is awkward and can take time, woke whites opt for easy, feel-good actions, most of which will have no effect on police brutality, on the quality of black schools, or neighborhoods, or on black lives generally. Most woke whites with have good intentions, but their symbolic gestures will, at best, have little effect and, at worst, do real harm. The campaign against police is a good example. Broad anti-police sentiment has already caused cops to become less proactive in high-crime neighborhoods, with the predictable result that shootings have spiked around the country. Whites are engaging in activism motivated by a misperception about black life that doesn't comport with reality for most blacks. With their views of blacks as wounded and perpetually oppressed, woke whites would do more good by doing nothing. Charles Love is the Assistant Executive Director of Seeking Educational Excellence. This originally appeared in the Manhattan Institute City Journal. Charles Love joins me in just a moment. I talked to him not too long ago. I originally read this article back in June, so he asked me about the statistics, and I didn't quite remember, and I got them wrong, but he straightens me out. Anyway, my conversation with Charles Love. Charles Love, author, educator, cultural analyst, thank you for joining me on the podcast, and thank you so much for that incredible piece that you wrote over the summer. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
And you've got a, you too have a podcast, although it's a radio show first. Is that right?
Yes, the Charles Love Show. I air it on terrestrial radio and then edit out commercials and post it on the internet for everyone to listen to.
So I don't know if, I guess that's the way to do it because you have a radio station basically handling a lot of the technical aspects. They take care of all that stuff for you. Cause I got to tell you, running a podcast is, a lot harder than I thought it would be. This is the nice part talking to you, but everything else is kind of hard.
Yeah. I look at mine being kind of a hybrid. So there's pluses and minuses to it. You know, people are getting used to the podcast, of course, and the advantage that you may have from that standpoint is you get to decide how long you want it to be, right? You can do 40 minutes. Some people do 15 minutes. Some people do 2 hours. But I got a set time on the radio, so it's kind of like a mini version of your TV show. I get ins and outs, and I got times to hit commercials. And you know, some people come on and it's like, they're talking, and they don't get the music playing behind them and that kind of thing. So that makes it a little different.
And actually, you're probably more disciplined than I am because I'm coming from a TV show where it's all, you know, yeah, just like that. Commercial breaks and coming up and all this stuff, and it's intense. This is loosey-goosey, and I can lose my place, and I can, you know, there's a freedom here. But sometimes there's too much freedom. Anyway, so far so good. Yours is a big success. Charles, look, I remember exactly where I was when I saw that piece that you wrote. It was published as well in the New York Post. Everybody who's listening is familiar with it. I thought, first of all, congratulations. It was one of those pieces that folks remember for a long time. What was the reaction when you put it out there?
Well, the reaction was phenomenal. It was greater. I was on cloud nine, and not because I got a lot of reaction, but it was because I get very little negative reaction. That's what was shocking about it, because it's just so common sense, but it might be common sense to me. So let's see what people would think. But no, it was great, and it was where I got the comments from. So I got comments and reactions from major players. I was on your show. Megyn Kelly started to follow me on Twitter. You know, Newt Gingrich. That was like, oh, that's cool. But then my friends from high school, you know, these, you know, what you would think as the normal, you know, everyday black folks who think whatever they think, whatever the stereotype might be, and we'll get into some of that, calling me saying, or people who are liberal calling me saying, I wanted to hate what you wrote, but I agree with every word you said. That was what really impacted me the most.
You know, a piece like that comes out, for me, I kind of expect the world to change. I mean, your world changed a bit. Like, you know, that's kind of wild stuff. Megyn Kelly, you know, you go on TV, all these people reach out. But at the same time, even a piece as successful as yours, it blows over pretty quick. I mean, like, people move on the Twitterverse extremely fast. Like, you said you were kind of on cloud nine. Did you also have a bit of a crash? Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, nothing systemically changed. And it's foolish to think that anything, one article is going to change the system. But what was that like when, and correct, you can tell me if I'm wrong. I'm imagining that, you know, the world did not change as a result of this very important essay.
Well, that's true in a sense. if you look at it from a larger standpoint, but I look at things different. I'm a realist more than I am anything politically or anything else. Let's look at it this way. I was drug into this reluctantly. This was never really my goal. It's not like I was a journalism major. It's not like I said, I'm going to go out here and be an activist or something or whatever other people call themselves. You know, my journey here was different. So my reaction was different. So it was kind of like, I don't like what the left is saying at all. And I don't like the way the right is saying what they're saying. So I may agree with them on the issues, but I'm like looking at them and saying, dude, no one's going to listen to you with that delivery. Let me help. So I didn't really have the crash, so to speak, because I didn't write it thinking a lot of people were going to. So it's not even like I wrote this piece. Let's talk about that. So I didn't write the piece and say, hey, I hope a lot of people read this. Right. It's kind of like when I wrote my first book, it wasn't supposed to be a book. I'm just jotting stuff down because I see this madness and I'm just writing down my thoughts. So so this particular piece led up this way. So obviously the George Floyd killing happened. People were just animated more than we had ever seen it before. The noise was at a level unseen. And so I sit back. I don't want to have a gut reaction. So I'm watching people. But then the responses were just so insane. So I started coming. I had to go back and find it on Facebook because I wanted to mention some of it because I went back on a rant at the end of May, right before I wrote that article. And I just started posting for 2 days on Facebook and Twitter, just nonstop, just posting stuff. And a lot of my friends, they were getting upset. They were like, what are you talking about? I said, read the comments because I'm a very literal person and I don't say what I don't mean. So it was the attack on the Black conservatives. It was, you know, why now? And what are you up? Let's get to the base of what you're really upset about. So that was the catalyst for the article. So I go through that. I write the article. So I'm just like, I'm just going to put this somewhere. And so I'm talking to someone at City Journal and it's like, do you mind if we post it? That's really good. You mind if we post it? I don't care. And I just gave it to him, you know? So I really didn't have any expectations until after the fact. And really, even though the people who were reaching out, what really did it, to be honest, and it's timely now, is the Post picked it up because it was originally a City Journal. And I think in a week it got like 9,000 views, which is good. And I was like, okay, that's cool. But when the Post picked it up, Rush Limbaugh read it on his show. And that was the difference.
Yeah.
From that standpoint. So from that height, definitely more people heard it. And then from there it went down. But my goal was always to get people to look at things logically. So the only really thing was that, you know, maybe some more people are listening to the other things you do after the fact. So I wouldn't say that, yeah, the world didn't change, but in a sense, it helped me kind of, because I had my message pretty honed, but it helped me, you know, realize what the best game plan was for me. Because everybody's like, I don't knock anybody else's approach because the left is so aggressive. We need everybody. I joke with my conservative friends. I'm like, we need the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, you know, people that coach is going to take you in at halftime and say, you're down 15. This is how we're going to come back. Nobody's quitting on me, right? Hmm. But then you need the people who are more cerebral and academic. So, I consider myself the bridge between the two because the average people aren't going to listen to them.
The average people are not going to listen to this.
The academics.
The eggheads. Well, yeah, no. You're right. They are elitists talking to elite audiences, and those audiences, by definition, are very small. So I guess big picture, why I wanted to talk to you is I have this theory, or I guess it's a phrase. I think America is having a very silly conversation right now about race in order to avoid a serious, more important conversation about race, that a lot of the issues that need to be discussed aren't being discussed. There are a lot of reasons for that. And one are the woke white liberals are either not brave enough, smart enough, or with it enough to go there. And that kind of was part of your piece. What's the upshot? What's the number one problem with, or the number one misconception that woke white liberals have right now about race in America?
Wow. You know, there's many of them. But if I had to say number one, it's number one because it's not just them. It is the number one misconception that Americans have. And different percentages, like if I say what percentage of Blacks have that belief, it'll be smaller, but there's still some. And they don't even realize it until you mention it. So I would say the biggest thing is a misconception about, I think I touched on it briefly in the article, about what the average Black person's life is like. You watch the news, you hear the stories, you see the way they craft TV shows. Now, I've been a Black man for a couple of years, so I kind of know what it's like, and I watch these shows. And this is, and it started even when I was young. I just noticed it. My mom said I always just thought differently. So I noticed it. And I said, this is interesting. If you want to point out something because you're making a point because there's something bad and you want to fix it, that's fine. But we have gotten to a point that we're creating the narrative that this is what the average Black person in America's life is like. So what I was trying to say in the article is that's a problem because it affects how you want to address it. If you think it's a problem, and it is a problem, but you say the whole building is on fire, you will react differently than if you have a rag on fire and you threw it in the sink and you're running water on it, right? So how you react will be different. So if everything is the entire, there was a five block explosion, is if that's the way you approach it, it's going to be a problem. So I say that because, and let's take stats real quick. Everybody looks at stats, and the stats are what they are. Now, granted, people can skew them and leave stuff out and try to manipulate them, but let's take that away. What I say is, you know, some people look at crime stats, and the average person, depending on their left-leaning or right-leaning, will say, see, you keep talking about police shootings, I'm sorry. There's very few of them per capita when you consider the population of Blacks and the number of police every day.
Let me jump in for 1 second. You were talking about the average perception that white people have and some Black people have of the average Black person. And what is that misperception?
Oh, that they're all either criminals, poor, or uneducated.
That's what I believe it is. So, and that is interesting because it's prevalent, I believe, you're right, among woke white liberals who happen to be, for the most part, elite. And by elite, I mean largely educated at four-year private colleges. I think that's how David Brooks would define elite, which is different from working-class white people, because guess what? Well, working-class white people are exposed to more Black people and people of color. That's true. It's totally unmentioned in this silly conversation America's having right now, that working-class people get it more than white elites.
Can I give you another ugly part, though?
Is that true?
It's 100% true, but let me give you another ugly part. Let me muddy your water a little bit more. So you take the average Black person, you know, married to Black married couple. They grew up in a Black neighborhood. They know everybody in the family, all their friends. They know Black people. They know the struggle. But now it's just like anything else. You grew up, you know, poor, whatever, but you move up, you work hard, you move up. So because this stuff is in the ether, and this is what I try to yell at people, because Julianne Moore is on TV saying all Black people are being shot, because every movie, because Amazon says when you turn on Netflix, you can't watch Netflix without them saying, stop shooting Black people. You put it out there enough. I mean, the human mind is the human mind. It doesn't have a race. So it becomes part of the culture. So here's an example. And, you know, as a Black person, you can do this more than most white people, regardless of whether they're elite. I talk to my middle-class Black men who are now in their 50s and they're successful. They're living what, you know, the life that very few white people live, right? And they don't have all these issues. But if you ask them, they will sound like the white elite at first. They'll say, well, the cops are shooting all of us. They'll say, well, they're hunting us down. It's the reason why, if you take logic out and add in emotion, it's the reason why LeBron James can get on TV and say all Black men are being hunted. Well, whatever your view on the race issue in this country and what needs to be fixed, anybody's common sense should tell you every Black man, LeBron James is not being hunted. We know where you are. So there has to be something to that LeBron James says that. And some of the people, I don't know about LeBron, but I can guarantee you some of these celebrities and wealthy Black people truly believe it. Gary Clark Jr. said he's afraid to leave the house. He's a Grammy Award-winning artist. I don't think he's just saying that to be cool, but I feel sorry for him because no one's after him, but he believes it. So I continue the conversation with my friend, and they'll say, yeah, racism everywhere, cops this. And then I say, okay, you're 52 years old. Last night you've been profiled. I can't remember, 10, 12, 13 years ago. What about your friends? What about this? And when they think about it, then they're like, you know what? This is not epic. Why am I thinking this? But they're not going to think that if we're constantly telling, if every time you see the news, if every movie you see is telling you that, then they believe that. Well, so that's the problem with the stats. Even with, that's where I was going with the stats. The stats may say it, but it's like the Richard Pryor skit where he cheated on his girl. And she's like, I saw you cheating. He's like, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
That was a Richard Pryor line?
Yeah, from Live on the Sunset Strip, I think it was.
So, all right, but let me ask you this. Netflix and the TV shows. I mean, the TV shows that you and I grew up on, say, Starsky and Hutch or whatever. I mean, like all that stuff where the prototypical bad guy might have been a black guy. That's not happening anymore. There's been like a huge shift, and maybe it's probably for the better, but, you know, Netflix probably more than anybody. They're totally revamping the roles and race, and they're addressing stereotypes. I think this is both good and also it's gone a little bit overboard. You watch a commercial these days, almost all the couples are racially mixed. Have you noticed that? I mean, Joe Biden, it's okay for me to say I've noticed it. And Joe Biden said the other night that he noticed it and nobody batted an eye. Do you think, first of all, what are your thoughts on this reimagining of black characters in entertainment? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it neutral? What's the deal?
It's definitely, what you said is true. It's happening. It's intentional. It is an overcorrection. That the goal was, you know, every black person on TV can't be a criminal or whatever, but now they overcorrect it. And it still goes to a perception problem. And you create, so you're going to have everything you do in Hollywood is painting a picture and you want it, trying to get a reaction. So you're going to create a belief in some people. It's not like, I don't get it. It's not like it's going to make people say that, wow, this must be what, because it's confusing to what they're saying. They're saying all black people have these terrible and miserable lives, but you want to show all these black people in an attempt, obviously, to show them in their best light. But now on TV, everyone's running everything. I talk about that in my book, how I watch TV shows now almost as a social analysis. And I look at every TV show. I watch a lot of procedural crime shows. And every show has a black lead. So if the FBI director, the fire chief, the police chief, the mayor, the governor, they're all black. The DNI, they're all black.
Are they black leads, or are they black just like, are they black characters or black people filling prominent roles like the mayor, but the show is really about the detective? Like,
yeah, it's kind of both, like Chicago PD, you mean, right? So, but yeah, you make a good point. So like they have, and most of them, you're right, they're not the main character. So you take Blacklist. Blacklist is not about, it's about the criminal Ray Reddington, right? So Raymond Reddington's there. He's James Spader. He's not black, but who's running the FBI? Right. Blind Spot was about the woman that they found in the bag in the middle of New York, in Manhattan. But the FBI director there was black.
So do you think that's a little bit of and there's a hell of a lot of this going on across society, but, and that's been happening in Hollywood, virtue signaling. It's like, OK, you know, we're going to carve out these minor spaces for these people of color so we can keep doing our own thing. I think that's been going on for a long time. Now you see the lead roles themselves being occupied by people of color. And again, I think a lot of this is great. I do have a sidebar I want to run by you later. You're certainly noticing that. Like, for instance, like Black Panther came out a couple of years ago, and that was a major moment. That was fantastic. Yeah. I was, quite frankly, a little uncomfortable that so much was being made of this guy's black. I mean, what do you think of the phrase that I hear a lot from young people, but really from advertisers and politicians, you know, finally somebody who looks like me. It's great that Kamala Harris, I'm a young black girl and I see Kamala Harris as vice president, and finally somebody looks like me. Does that resonate with you? Do you like it? Is it a healthy thing or not so much?
It, like most things, is a mix. I get it. I'm not a big fan, not because I don't understand why some people would like it, and not because I don't want it. I have something against someone who looks like whomever, myself or someone else in that looks like me, a woman or whatever, having someone in a particular role. What saddens me is because what it tells me is that someone, a teacher, a parent, a religious leader, or someone in their past failed them, right? Because what it's saying is somehow they got the notion, whether directly or indirectly, that they can't be a lawyer, an engineer, the president, or whatever this position is, unless they see somebody in it. So because what's the difference between a Black kid having a strong family and wanted to be a cop because the neighborhood cop was a really nice guy and he was white? Unless somebody tells them you can't do that, I don't see why they would think that. I never had that when I was growing up. I mean, I grew up in a majority Black neighborhood, so I saw people who did everything, and I appreciate the fact that I know every Black person doesn't see that. But my dad would never let me grow up thinking that I couldn't do anything, or thinking this job is for white people and this job is for Black people. So it never even crossed my mind that I couldn't do anything. So I get that it may be helpful for some, but it's most helpful for those who were lacking that you know, adult in their life who can put them on the right path to begin with. Because I guarantee they were coming from a strong family who was supporting them, who got them a great education, but told them that the sky is the limit. You can do everything. You can do whatever. Because if you're watching a guy and he's playing the cello and you loved it and you just fell in love with the cello, so they bought you a cello and gave you lessons, the likelihood in most orchestras, that guy's not going to be Black. But they take you under the wing and they take you out and they take you to concerts and they cultivate you because you like it and you fall in love with it. Your parents never telling you, hey, do you notice that there aren't any other Black people? They don't put that race thing on your shoulder. It's not going to stop you from playing cello.
Yeah. That's you said several things there that I'm glad I asked the question. And that's very interesting. Very interesting. And I'll run this by you. When I hear it, it quite frankly breaks my heart a little bit, because it says to me that you can only be inspired by people who look like you. And by the way, just because somebody is white, for instance, Joe Biden does not inspire me. You know what I mean? Because he's a white man. Now, I understand every president's been white except for the 44th president and that kind of thing. So you could argue that I've had all these role models. But truly, outside of my father, one of the most significant role models in my life was General Colin Powell. When I was in college, I was struggling academically, and he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I liked him for a couple of reasons. Number one, he was also from the Bronx. I was going to college in the Bronx. He went to a non-elite college. I was going to Fordham University, a private four-year school, but definitely not an elite college. He joked that he liked White Castle. There was an outsider status about him and a, kind of like a local hero. And those are the reasons why I really liked him. And also, he was a White House fellow, and my father had applied for that program. He became a finalist, but he never became a White House fellow. And he struck me as just a really interesting, accomplished man. Again, the White Castle thing is probably what I liked about him most. And he was Jamaican. And like, it really pains me when I hear, it sounds like it's such an inspiring thing, but I think it's just creating more and more division between us. That someone has to look like you to be an inspiration.
Well, you're talking about the race piece, but I have a problem with everyone. It's fine for a moment, but everyone going through life, living their life vicariously through other people. So other people who I don't know, their successes are my successes. And in a sense, they're saying their failures are also you taking on their failures, right? That's the reason why we have what I call selective empathy. You know, I have bringing it back to the article and Floyd and all that, I sit back and watch people. Again, I analyze people and find it fascinating that people decide to would write a sign and take to the street over the killing of someone they don't know. Now, I can see you saying, I saw this on video. Doesn't look right. I hope they bring person X up on charges. But to say, I am going to stop my life to focus on this thing and change, and I want to change my life because of this. Now, granted, it's because of all the other noise and people saying it's happening every day, which it's not. But it seems to me, the reason I call it selective empathy, I usually use an analogy. And I tell people when they say, well, you're just heartless and you don't care. I said, well, you know, this is one of the, there's three or four ways that I say, these are my examples that I know that there's a God. And one of them is the control of empathy. If we all, most of us are normal, caring people who really care about other people and don't want to see anyone hurt. If we had unlimited empathy that we could not control, we would never get out of bed. So I say, you see what happened to George Floyd, you think that that is bad, that's fine. Having an emotional reaction to that is okay. But going to that level, I ask you this question, there's still varying degrees of what you have a limited amount of empathy you can show. So I give people an example. I say, you got a clerk, a black kid, 18-year-old girl, first in a family to go to college. She got a full ride to an Ivy League school. But because her leaving the house would hurt the family financially, she took a part-time job anyway so she can send money back home. She's working at a clerk at a convenience store. Somebody takes the day off. She picks up the shift. Somebody comes in to rob the store. They put a gun in her face. She gives them money. She complies. They shoot her anyway and kill her. On the way out the store, the third person stops and says, hey, I think there's somebody in the back of the store, goes back there, kills them too. It's leading the news one night on a Saturday night. You're getting dressed to go to your friend's birthday party. You're putting on your clothes. You hear it. You pop your head out. You're like, oh, that's awful. You get dressed. You go to the club. What is the average person's reaction? They go to the club. They ask their friends, did you see the news on you when you were getting dressed? No, I didn't see it. They tell them what happened. They said, that's awful. And then they go to the dance floor and then they buy a bottle. And that doesn't make them an evil person. And no one can tell me I'm lying. That's what happens, correct?
Yep.
So are you telling me this poor 18-year-old black woman from the hood who got a full ride scholarship at Harvard, who got shot just for being in the wrong place for the wrong time by an evil, heinous criminal, but you don't spend as much empathy on her as you do, or the person who's been, you know, human trafficked, or the innocent person who did X, Y, Z. You don't pay as much, have as much empathy for that person as you do somebody with a long criminal record, but he was wronged by a police officer. So explain that to me. You see what I mean by my mind works differently?
Oh, it's fascinating. And what a great example. Although I would say this, if that happened, a young woman shot at Harvard, I don't know if it was a woman you mentioned or not. I had a woman in my mind who was working in a convenience store. I mean, has that ever happened?
I mean, people get shot at convenience stores.
I would just say, no.
I don't know if they have to be the 18-year-old black woman.
Going to Harvord.
Worse than it could have been, right?
Well, that story right there is a big story. You know what I mean? Like, if that actually happened.
Oh, without a doubt, it's a story. It's a story.
A story, but it's not going to.
People aren't on the street.
Maybe, yes, you're right. No, point taken. I totally get it. And you're right about the club. Yeah, you watch
that
the news, then you leave.
That person stopped for 5 minutes at the club. They stopped to say, you know, maybe the really nice people said, let's have a moment of silence for the girl who got shot. Well, and then they went on to celebrate the birthday party.
Which is fine.
They had to stop their life.
Right. No, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the way, right. And you've got to be selectively empathetic. And I get that. It actually reminds me of a story I once heard. A woman at a dinner party said to me, I can't remember the context, but she said, it's much easier to call for change in others than it is to change ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the George Floyd massive turnout, which, by the way, that case is arguably more complex than we've been led to believe, than I was initially led to believe, than I initially thought. I'd like to talk about that in a little bit. But first, do me a favor. Where were you born?
Gary, Indiana. Born and raised.
That's where the Jacksons were from, right?
Yeah, I've never heard that before. Yes.
You always hear that?
The Jacksons, and I throw out the other ones because everybody says, you know, the Jacksons and who else? That's pretty much who they say, but people forget, the older people, the younger people would know, but Ron Kittle was from there.
I don't know who
Carl
that is.
Carl Malden was from there.
Carl Malden, the actor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's funny, Maya Zumwalt, the person who produces this podcast, I think you were in touch with, her grandfather was portrayed by Carl Malden in a movie. Her grandfather was Elmo Zumwalt, the admiral, famous admiral. And Carl Malden, the American Express guy. Anyway, but growing up in Gary, Indiana, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have two brothers and one much older sister.
What did your parents
do? I'm the youngest.
You're the youngest. And what did your parents do?
My mom was a housewife and my dad worked in the mill.
What kind of mill was there?
Steel mill. You know, it was supposed to be, Gary was supposed to be the city of the future.
What did you like in school? What subjects were you best at?
Easily math. I was an unfortunate student in that I was hurt because things came so easy to me. So I didn't learn to study till I was about 25.
You were, well, I was not, I didn't have that problem. I was terrible in math. What was the racial makeup of your community or your school?
Oh, you don't know Gary. Let me give you a little Gary history. Gary is probably one of the most highly populated black cities in the country. I don't know where it lies now, but growing up, it probably was in the top three, except there were two neighborhoods that were majority white. If you took them out, we were probably in the 90s. I grew up, I think there was a white girl my freshman year, but she got pregnant and dropped out. And there were like one other kid in my high school. Other than that, the whole time of school, never being around a white kid.
Okay, where did you go to college?
I like to say I dropped out of IU. I went to Indiana University.
In Bloomington?
And then, yeah, in Bloomington. And then I took a long pause, went to a restaurant business, and went back while I was in the restaurant business and finished my degree while I was working in restaurants. But that's where I went after school.
Can I ask you, Indiana University, great campus, at least as I saw it in a movie called Breaking Away. Did you ever see that movie?
It's a beautiful campus. Yes. Uh-huh.
About the bike guy. And yep. So why did you drop out?
Like I said, I think that, you know, I had wasn't ready from a discipline because of school, in the sense that, like I said, I never had to study, and we didn't have the whole thing now. Like I hear the schools where they say the teachers are all focused on the test, study for the test. We didn't have that when I was in school. But the problem was, I liken it to a union. It didn't regulate fairness. They regulated sameness. So if they had one speed. Right. So if you were slower, you kind of got lost in the shuffle. And if you were faster, they didn't challenge you. So I was the kid that they sat in front of the class whenever there was a math test, because everybody was going to copy off my test. But I wasn't challenged. And I'm 16. So it's not like I'm asking to be challenged. And they did not. So, you know, I would do all my homework in the class and never take a book home. So I never had that, you know, I struggled with studying for a while. So, you know, when you are now competing with, you know, at a different level with other students, I'm like, what, I gotta go come out of the class and then, you know, work on this for 2 or 3 hours to get it. You know, it just took a while for me to get to that point. I had to mature a little bit more, I guess.
And, okay. So the restaurant business, college degree, what was your first job outside of restaurant thing? Once you got your degree?
Well, I worked in the restaurant industry for 20 years. So.
Oh, wow. That wasn't a fly-by-night thing.
No, I ended up, you know, staying there, running, working for chains, managing restaurants, you know, owned the restaurant before I got out of the industry. You know, the collapse of 2007 and 8 really ended my restaurant and getting married to somebody who worked in 9-to-5. Like, stop working nights and weekends. But yeah, I was in the industry for a while.
I always wondered what it was like. Like, there we are enjoying ourselves, having a nice time, you know. Going to a restaurant is still kind of a special thing. And you see people who, like, they're working. It's their job. It's like their Tuesday. It's not a special night. And
right.
I don't know. I mean, obviously you guys like it. There are all kinds of benefits, right? I mean, you don't have to get up early.
Oh, it was like Mardi Gras. It's built for the young, though. And the career and the industry had to kind of recreate and adjust itself. Because if you're young, especially, you know, if you didn't if you don't want an office job, it's like an ATM. You can make cash, you make good money, but you know, the hours are long and all that kind of stuff. So when you're young, you don't care. But what happened, the industry started to see that people would do that for a while and love it. But then when they hit the early to mid 30s and they started to settle down, they would leave the industry because the hours were too long. So they had too much turnover. So they started to, so now most of these big restaurants have limits on how long the managers work, which is still longer than normal. So probably like they got 50 hour shifts, so 45 hour shifts. When I was working, they didn't have any. Most people were working 55 hours, 60 hours a week. And then they got off and then they went to party.
Yeah, that's a hell of a life. That's intense. What about, I heard that managers, one of the big things that you've got to look for is theft. Is that true? That thievery is one of the biggest banes of the restaurant business, and you got to keep your eyes out. Is that
oh, it's not even close. I used to go to my employees and say, I know you're going to steal. We need to put a limit on how much you steal. That's how bad it is. I mean, your bartender is going to give his friend a draft beer every once in a while. You don't even consider him a thief. You consider him a thief if he does it every day, or if he's, you know, pouring people shots of the good liquor. He's got to give a
With the good liquor that they still play that game. Like here's the on display. There's good liquor, and then it's really.
No, I'm saying he's going to be giving that away to his friend. You're like, I'd rather you give your friend an occasional draft beer than to be pouring him, you know, single malt all night. Because, I mean, it's just a nature thing. People are going to buy somebody a beer. They're going to buy a regular beer. They're going to buy the girl they like a beer. They're going to give their friend. So technically, is that though? Right? So yeah, it's pretty bad. It's just, you know, it happens and you find a way. I remember taking over a restaurant as a GM and they were losing money. And I walked in on my first day with a padlock, put a padlock on the freezer. Every day we would do a pool. I will then lock, you know, put it on a list. I will then lock the freezer and the freezer will be locked for the rest of the day. If you need something because you have a busy night, you come get me. That's how bad it was.
Let me ask you this. In that business, you hire a lot of different people, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My father has hired a lot of different people in his life. I don't know if he'll mind me saying this. I should ask him. But he told me that hiring people is basically, at the end of the day, a bit of a crapshoot. That somebody can make an impression in an interview, positive, whatever, but you just never really know how they're going to work out. Some people surprise you negatively and positively. There's only so much you can do ahead of time. What do you think? Is that your experience? And please tell me what yours is.
Oh, it's 100% like that. And no matter how good you think you are, that will happen because I try, and you get better at it in the sense that you start to understand the things you need to look for. The problem is when people first start hiring and they're new to it, they're hiring for the skills. Like, do you have the resident education? Do you know this? Do you know how to do this? Tell me how to make this drink. And if you know the recipe, that's fine. But I can't tell by that interview, can you balance, you know, three people at the bar at the same time and food and somebody interrupting you and do multiple things? You know, that's not going to be in the resume. And I don't know your honesty. I don't know, you know, unless your last employer is going to tell me whether you show up to work on time or not. And nowadays, with everything being so litigious, people are afraid to give you a bad review. So they used to, in the old days, they'd be like, oh, don't hire him. He's a bum. But no one was going to say that anymore because you'll sue. So now it's just like, you know, that's the next guy's problem. So you don't really know. And then I've had it the other way. I've had people that on paper, I'll give them a shot, but I don't think it's going to work out. And they ended up being great. You know, I might think that person, this is a server. This is personality. They're too rigid. Right. But they're the person that's not going to make as many mistakes. So yeah, it's really a crapshoot. You can't really account for a rapport or how they work with other people, or they might make more mistakes than the next person, but they're better at smoothing it over. Like I had servers who would make a mistake and you go to the table and the people are out there laughing. Oh, hey, Charles, you should hire another guy like Bob. He's great. And I'm like, Bob, just forgot to put your order in. Right. But he knows people. Right. So you can never account for it. I mean, it is definitely a crapshoot. And I find that it's the same, you know, now that, you know, it's a, not managing restaurants and you hire people to do other things. It's still the same. Can somebody, you hire somebody to build a website. They know the technical skills, but they don't do it on time. Or, you know, they're bullheaded. They want to do, I told you I wanted it to be red. Why is it blue? Well, I just thought blue was better. People are still people, I guess, right?
You know, when you go to a restaurant now, I bet you tip big time, right?
I tip big time. I've gotten better. My wife used to give me a hard time because I would critique everything. I don't do that so much, but yes, I am. I'm very generous tipper.
I think I do notice that people who have been in the business seem to be particularly empathetic and concerned. And there's like a almost a brotherhood sisterhood thing.
It's funny you said that. Most people are most shocked by this, and it is like that. You know, especially if you get to the management level and you work in management, work in restaurants, whatever. It is like that. And my wife, the one thing that surprised her the most is like everywhere we went, people would know me and they would just comp food. I didn't pay for food. And it wasn't a restaurant I worked at. Like we were at some French restaurant, never been in it before. And one of the busboys, because a lot of these people work in different restaurants and a couple people there knew me. And they were like, I remember you at the session session. And I get my bill to be half off. Oh, he doesn't have a bill. And she's like, why are these people? We're in Vegas and I see people know me. I'm like, that's what the restaurant industry is like. Like, I get tired of this food and I just go to a restaurant across the street, come and eat at my restaurant, whatever you want. And the manager was like, you can come and eat here. So you want to, because we're stuck eating that food every day, right? Because you're at work 10 hours a day. So when it's time for lunch, that's what you eat. So you want a bit of variety. So we all take care of each other. So yeah, it's really It's really cool. But
that is nice.
And the servers take care of each other. And that's kind of like why they tip really well too.
So you're in this business, and then you're also writing on the side, and you're noticing things, and you realize, you know, you've got some things to say. The restaurant business kind of takes a downturn in 2008, 2009. You got a book or two under your belt. How do you make that transition? How do you start branching out?
Well, I hadn't written my book. I wrote the book after that. Well, I actually left the restaurant industry because, you know, I went back to Gary because I'm like, we always talk about trying to bring things back to your community. But if there's nothing there, if everybody, they talk about Gary being a struggling community, but if everyone who succeeds leaves, what is the town left with? So go back, open a restaurant there. But unfortunately, what I found was people, you know, it's not like a big city like Chicago and New York. You open a place in the right neighborhood, people will come. Now, if you do a bad job, they'll stop coming. But you can just turn the lights on and people will come. There, it's like, well, I need word of mouth and I need to know and this kind of stuff. But I got a decent clientele. But so Gary is situated in an odd place next to Chicago. So on the east side, it's right on the lakefront. It's at the beach. So that's where a lot of the white people in the city live. So, and some people from Chicago had summer homes there. So most of my clientele were people with summer homes there. So when the market crashed, they just closed up the summer homes and stopped coming then. So when I ended up closing that, I was like, well, I need to go back to work. Hey, luckily when I was working in a restaurant the last couple of years, I went back and got a finance degree. So I went to work at PepsiCo and I worked there for a couple of years in supply chain, but I wasn't in finance and I left there when I got a finance job. And so that's what I was doing when I wrote the book. But the book came when Obama was running, because all of my friends who had never paid attention, all they were doing was keeping up with the Kardashians. And now Obama wins, and now they become these political commentators, right? And I'm a history guy, so I'm like, nothing that you're saying makes sense. So I just started taking notes of what they're saying and write down how everything they were saying was factually inaccurate. And it just came into this book. And that's what I did with the first one. And then the next one was just, you know, we want equality, how the fight for equality gave way to preference. And it was basically just a pushback to all these people lying to you, saying they want equality. And you can disagree with it or agree with it. At least I like the leftist who's honest. You don't want equality. What you want is justifiable inequality. Because you don't want anything to be equal. When you say, give us set-asides or we've been treated worse than others for a while, you need to fix that by treating us better and giving us the job or hiring the black guy first. And the future is black and the future is woman. That's not equality. It's simply not. And this was, 3 years ago? And now you hear it now. You hear them saying, we don't want equality. We want equity. That's what they wanted all along. At least now we've pushed them to the point that they're telling the truth. And so that's kind of why I wrote that. But really quick, I want to go back. You asked me what the biggest misconception was. And to put a finer point on it, you talked about my background. And my point is I grew up in Gary and I was poor. But they act like most black people are from single family homes, which it's happening more so now than it did in the past, that they're all in the drug game, that they're all dropping out of school and all this other kind of stuff. And that is just not the norm. And the reason in that article I was talking about stats, and obviously you can only make it so long, but my point was, some people look at the stats and say, police aren't killing people, blacks, as much as you say, here's the stat. Others say, blacks are committing murder at X times X. And so it depends on what number they pull out. The most important one that I never hear anyone pull out is, what percentage of blacks are committing violent crime? Do you know what that number is?
What percentage of blacks are committing violent crime?
Right, because we always hear it's X times whites, but they never tell you what the white number is. We need the whole equation.
So I saw some figures. I was pretty shocked. I saw them from the DOJ a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. It was slightly higher for whites, I believe, than blacks. It was also stunningly high. It was like 29% and 31% of all white men and black men will be arrested or have been arrested or are on probation or something crazy like that. That's what I remember.
Yeah, don't listen to that craziness. This is the number that most people need to start looking at. So push. My big push is to get the people to push for this number. So I'm looking at 2018 stats. It's the last one that I think I had pulled. So white males commit more of most crimes than black men, you know, as a percentage of the crime, not percentage of their population, except for murder and robbery. So that's insanely high for blacks. That is true. So that's the number where you hear people say blacks are five times more likely to XX. But what they don't do is give me the number of all of the violent crime arrests for blacks and for whites and divide that number of arrests. Keep in mind, some of those people may have been arrested more than one time and some people may get away. This is just the arrest. But divide that number of violent crimes by the population of whites and blacks. And what you find is the blacks have a slightly, almost three times the percentage of overall of all crimes. But we're focused on violent crime. For violent crime, for whites, it's 0.12. And for blacks, it's 0.44. So technically, they are. It used to be six. It's gone down, except for the last 2 years. So we are 3.5 times more likely to commit a violent crime than a white person. That's factually true. But what they never tell you is what the number is for whites. So my argument is, yes, if the number for, if you say three times and the number for whites is 30, then it's bad because then for blacks it's 90%. But they don't tell you that the number for whites is 0.12.
That's pretty wild.
My point is most black people don't break the law.
Most black people don't break the law. Most white people don't. Where are those numbers from, please?
Those are 2018 FBI stats.
Those are wild. But you know what I mean? I guess I'm talking about whatever the hell I saw a couple of years ago, incarceration rates or whatever, and that includes nonviolent.
Yeah, they say, I've seen that thing where everyone's chance is X based on a percentage, but they're doing rolling numbers when they say what, because if they're estimating what my chance is to go to jail, right? They're saying based on the A's, based on the groups, based on city versus rural, they factor in all these, but it's not really a real number, because what do you think of a black man who's a professional and in his 40s, chances are that's pretty low, right? So,
true.
But they lump me in as a black man, but you can't, right? So, because once you get over 35, they dramatically drop.
Yeah.
You factor the people in who've been in and out of prison a lot and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, those, all the numbers mean something, but the reason that number is most important to me, because everybody is moving, the fight on both sides, the yelling at each other, everybody is moving based on a belief that, you know, whites are intrinsically racist, that white police are attacking black men, black men are being hunted, and black men are violent because black men commit violent crimes at X times. But yes, they don't tell you what the other number is. And my point is, it's really low. I started saying we are the 98%. Because 99 was taken, really, I could have gone with 99. And people push back on me and say, your numbers are flawed because blacks commit, it's not 3%, it's more like 5 or 6% of crimes. Yeah, but you're talking traffic crimes. You're talking about all that stuff. I'm only talking violent. Violent is less than 1%.
Let me ask you this. So you just mentioned a whole bunch of popular misconceptions that are out there. Mm-hmm. How do they get turned around? Because right now, the society is not recognizing the truth that you just summarized. They're not. They're going further and further in the opposite direction. And it's been latched onto by this president, by the corporate culture, everything we look at, you know, from Netflix to sports, you know, it's baked in now that this is a systemically racist society, especially in the law enforcement sphere. I don't believe that's true because it's not true. And you helped. It's not true.
Right.
And you beautifully summarized. How do we turn that around? The perception. I mean, because it's actually not a problem. There are always things to improve in society, but first and foremost, the perception. How is this addressed? Because right now, I mean, we are, we're a very small number of people. Actually, maybe not. There are, 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. Something tells me that they don't believe that America is systemically racist. But anyway, let me stop. How do we turn this around?
Yeah, but unfortunately, and every day it's getting harder to do. I got to admit that it's getting harder to do. But in some way, I don't know if I still do. For a while, right before the election, I was like, I still see a glimmer of hope, but it's ugly. And I'm all about truth. So you're not going to like it. So fasten your seatbelts. But here's the thing. Even those 75 million people you mentioned, all of them may not necessarily know how to. So the majority of them probably don't think the country's racist, but they don't know how to convince the other 200 and change. How to not think, they don't know how to convince Nike to stop being stupid, So how do you do that, right? So my thing is twofold. And where I push back, and I need people with, like you with your platform to push back, is that obviously I'm a conservative, so I lean right. But I still get mad at the writer, how they express things. And I don't think that because we let it go too far. Unfortunately, I don't think that we can fix it by ourselves on the right. That's just my little corner of the world. What I try to do is I reach out to liberals, not the left. There's no sense trying to speak to them because they're irrational and they're just going to call your name. But liberals, and this is that's why I say I'm like the tortoise. It's slow. It's a slow burn, but it's necessary. You got to do the hard work. Go to the liberals and the left-leaning and right-leaning people who don't consider themselves in the box and say, look, you disagree with me on issues, probably 70%. Don't care. But you agree with me that the cancel culture and this woke movement and this race-focused movement is dangerous to the country. So why don't we fix that? And then we can argue about policy later. I'm saying is we need liberals. Because they're out there, you know. I try to get them on the show.
Sorry, wait. Just keep going. We need liberals to what?
We need liberals to push back against the left and say, I don't like Donald Trump. I don't agree with Fox News. I don't like Newsmax, whatever silliness they want to say. However, I am more concerned by, you know, teaching 10-year-old boys that their white guilt is a problem in the school. I am more concerned by taking black kids into school who were failing 5 years ago because of poor curriculum and poor teachers, and wasting time talking about slavery like the 1619 Project.
So who are the liberals who are going to do that? Because I don't know of any. The only one I know of actually is Professor Alan Dershowitz, who is a self-described liberal Democrat. And he has been confronting, actually not issues of race. He certainly is not in favor of the woke mob. And he has grave concerns about what big tech is doing. There's one, but who are the other?
I can give you a long list of them.
Give me some.
They're out there. Who can I think of? Sam Harris.
Sam Harris, yeah, that guy.
Greg Lukianoff considers himself a liberal.
What's his name?
Greg Lukianoff from FIRE, the free speech organization on college campuses, mm-hmm. FIRE. Helen Pluckrose. The Tiger Mom woman, Amy Chua, Dr. Gadsad in Montreal. I'm having him on next week. All he does is tweet about the left.
And he's on the left.
Yeah, they're all either center left or they may not consider it. They're not Republicans. I can tell you that much. Yeah.
Well, these are important.
Classical liberal, they'll say.
Classical liberal. They're not exactly, well, Sam Harris is famous. Helen Pluckrose, I got to admit, I haven't heard of her.
She wrote a book called, it's like Critical Theories. It's called Cynical Theories. And it's like the critical is drawn through and it's cynical. As I think about it, I've seen you a couple of them. Those are the people I try to get on and challenge to say, why aren't you speaking up? Oh, what about Yalcha Monk? YASCHAMOUNK.
Who is it? Just say the name, please.
Yalcha Monk.
I thought you said Mao Zedong for a moment. I'm like,
yeah,
well, can I run this by you? I have a feeling that there is an unusual and unique alliance that can be forged between people of color who have actually and legitimately been oppressed and discriminated against, and some working class white people who are feeling the sting, possibly for the first time ever, of being judged for something they can't control. And that's their race. That's their ethnicity. Yeah. That's their orientation. I have felt that, quite frankly, in the past couple of years. I've expressed this out loud, not often. The reaction has been mixed. One Hispanic individual who I know and love dearly and another African-American individual who I know and love dearly were perhaps the least sympathetic. And they said, now you know how it feels.
Well, that's childish.
I quite frankly thought so too, but it is, you know, we didn't have I forgive them. I mean, they didn't walk in my shoes, just like I couldn't walk in someone else's shoes. Although in a weird way, what am I trying to say here, dude? I'm trying to say that I have a unique and a new empathy for anybody who's been discriminated against based on things they can't control. I may not have paid the price that they did. Certainly never was physically harmed, thrown in jail, but I know what it feels like a little bit, and it's terrible, and it stings, and it's bad. And I don't know if there is something there between, is there, or am I just, should I just shut up now?
Well, no, it is, but the problem is not with you. The problem is with the person who's willing to say, now you see what it's feel, what it feels like. What is wrong with you? I mean, we know about the nasty and racist and evil and vile and violence history of the world, not just America, but that's happened in the past. And you want to say, well, you want to say to people who had nothing to do with it, now you see what it feels like? What, I mean, how does that bridge any gap? I mean, no one's going anywhere. Nobody's going back to Africa. Nobody's going to Europe. Nobody's chopping up the country. Stop being a four-year-old. So it's not happening. So you have to exist with these people, these liberals and these conservatives and these white people and these Jewish people and these women. You have to exist with them. So you think because you tweet something mean to somebody and you got something over to somebody that when you go to the gas station and because you need gas and you run out of gas, that kind gentleman who helped you might be one of those people you don't like? I mean, that's silly. And what they're doing, that's why my big push is to get people to understand, because black people know it. You know, they, some of them may be indifferent by because it's not happened to them, because, you know, we are all about self-preservation as humans. But they know that what BLM and 1619 pushing is 1950s Selma with difference with a skin color swap. They know if it's wrong to say only blacks can go over there, it's wrong to say only hire blacks. They have common sense. They know that. They know what this push is. It's nothing but racism. They know BLM is a lesbian and trans organization that has nothing to do but weaken black men. They know that BLM has gotten $100 million and they have not spent $4.36 in the black community. They're not stupid. Right? I get friends who still live in majority black neighborhoods that are like, yeah, I've never seen BLM around here anywhere. They've never done anything. So why are you giving them money? It's the corporate people that don't get it. They get it. The problem is they're saying, well, nobody came to our defense, so why should we come to theirs? But first of all, what defense? Nobody's oppressing you. Are there things that are unfair? Yes. But if the biggest way to get out of it is education, which is why I focus on that, why aren't you focusing on that? It is not in today's country, it is not Republicans or white people who are filling your schools in Chicago, who are causing this high dropout, who are teaching your kids. So what they want today is they want the white kids to learn the code and the black kids to learn about slavery. Okay, in 20 years, who do you think is going to be better positioned for a career? You're not doing anything to help. So I say focus on STEM and stop worried about the other stuff. Focus on your house, right? Focus on your kids. You know, you have a household where you think it's you're making fun of, or a neighborhood where they make fun of you for how you speak. They make fun of you because you speak proper English. Why are you sounding like you're white? So
that's still a thing, by the way.
BLM is the one that's saying, you know, posting silly stuff. They're saying being on time is whiteness. Reading a book is whiteness. You know, you have to live in that society. You can change everything you want to change. There's no way. Reality. I give them reality. In 5 years, the blacks will not run every company. So at some point, you get that finance degree, that engineering degree. You're not going to work for a black guy. And if you do, and he does own it, he's a professional black guy. I went to Harvard. I went to Michigan. And, you know, he's not going to be like, I'm okay with you being late every day and not knowing how to do your job. It's just like most of these cities now, they push for, you know, people that look like us, as you mentioned earlier. So all these major cities, did you notice this? Of course you did. Your father's in law enforcement. All these major cities had black and female police chiefs and commissioners, right?
Yes. And
can
also
I ask you a question? Did the shooting stop? Both black on black crime or police shootings, did they stop? Because I tell people, let's be real. It's dark outside. They got a report of a man with a gun. They show up. The woman's bleeding. They see him running. They chase him. Their adrenaline is flowing. It's dark outside. It's rainy. He turns with a weapon. They are not going to stop. Not a cop in America is going to cop and stop and say, well, would BLM like me to shoot this guy? Or what should I do? It's not going to happen. That black man is shot. So do you want to live in the real world and solve the problems, or do you just want to say, throw your hands up and say, it's not my fault? you know, they said the same thing about the guy in Kenosha. He didn't have a, he was unarmed. He was unarmed. I'll leave you there. I know I'm going off on a rant because this just bothers me. But you're in the news. You report what's happening every day. This is the one that gets me all the time. I had somebody on the show and it blew him away. Even on the right, we make this mistake. So they're reporting on Jacob Blake. Remember him in Kenosha?
Mm-hmm.
And the left was like, oh, no, man, he didn't do anything. Shot seven times, whatever. And then the right would say, well, they're saying he got shot seven times because of this, but I think he had a weapon. He was shot seven times, but it was because he had a warrant out for his arrest. And I'm like, all of you people, stop. I got one question. Prove to me he got shot seven times. He got shot at seven times. We have still yet to confirm how many times he actually got shot. I think it's three or four. I had to do some digging, and I get two different numbers. But none, zero, not even his lawyers say seven. But still to this day, they reported. 2020 interviewed him and said he got shot seven times. So I asked my friend one day, I said, if I shoot at you three times and I miss, how many times did I shoot you? He said, none. I said, so why are we going around saying Jacob Blake got shot seven times?
That was Charles Love. I really liked talking to him. I did not know that the restaurant portion would be as interesting as it was. I found that really cool as well. What a thinker. We're going to talk again very soon. Part two will be forthcoming. Thank you very much. Thank you for liking, for subscribing, and all that stuff. We'll see you on TV, I hope. Take care.